go ahead and start back into the public hearings portion of Senate Bills 5507, 5508, and we'll continue on. Mr. Plotty has just finished up with the issues relative to the insurance division, and let's see, Robin, where do we proceed from there?
The last item that we have with the insurance division is discussion of the policy option package, and so if Mr. Ario could finish up with that, that would be great.
Okay, thank you. Chairman Butler, members of the committee, the option packages are on page 61 of your summary booklet. There are three of them listed there, but the first one is really a budget revision that I think Debbie Lincoln has already covered. It's related to the workers' comp assessment, so unless there are questions, I'll not go into the detail on that one. It essentially just transfers money from one area to another. The option package 142, as was noted by Satish, has been dropped. The reason for that was that we were trying to achieve some efficiencies by moving some tax responsibilities from the Department of Revenue over to our department so that they could be better coordinated. When we got into the detail and learned what the IRS was going to require of our department in terms of security, the efficiencies that we were hoping to gain went away, and it was actually going to be a net inefficiency probably by the time we were done, and so we pulled the bill. We will go back and look at that approach again and see if we can work something out that would be satisfactory to the IRS that would result in an efficiency gain for everybody. But right for this session, that package is off the table. That leaves option package 141, which we are proposing, and that package essentially provides two new positions within the division. The first of them, the public service rep for position, is for our senior counseling program for Medicare. As the Congress continues to tinker with the details of Medicare and make it more and more complicated for seniors to understand the program, they've provided more money. In this case, they've actually provided more money to the states for these counseling programs to help seniors navigate that system. So this position is proposed so that we will be able to take advantage of the full grant, federal grant money that is offered to us for those kind of counseling programs. And again, that program works primarily on by volunteers, so it's a heavily leveraged kind of program. We have three, with this package, we have three employees, and we'd be working with something like 220 volunteers who do most of the face-to-face work with seniors in terms of the counseling. The other position, the insurance examiner 2 position, is in line with some of the changes that we're making because of, again, the federal coordination that we're moving towards in insurance regulation. It's a lot of that, the emphasis, for instance, in rates and forms is on streamlining front-end access to the market for insurance companies, which puts a corresponding responsibility on us to do more effective back-end monitoring of the marketplace, and this position is to help with that. A common line these days from insurers is, let us get into the market more easily, and then look at those of us who cause problems in the market and go after us. But don't hold everybody up on the front end because you think there may be problems. Let us in and then look carefully at our market behavior and go after the bad apple, so to speak. So this position reflects that kind of focus to do more with our market conduct program, particularly in the life and health industries, which is where the laws are changing most rapidly and there's the most need to monitor compliance. With that, I should talk very briefly on page 62. If you look at our revenues, this last point I'll cover, you'll see that our revenues come primarily from three different sources. First is, and most important, is fees and charges for services. That accounts for 51% of our budget. Mostly that's on the agent side with agent licensing and so forth. There's some company fees in there, too. Second most important source of funding for us is insurance premium assessments. They account for about 25% of our budget. And then third, we have company examination fees. When we go out and do either financial or market conduct examinations, we bill companies directly for the costs associated there, and that accounts for 14% of our budget. Workers' compensation is listed here. That's now less than 4% of our budget after the proposed changes. It'll be down, I think, about 3% after the proposed changes in the assessment. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Oriu. I had just a couple of questions relative to the Graham Leach Bliley Act. That's a federal mandate. Are there any federal funds that come with that particular mandate?
Mr. Chairman, there were no specific federal funds earmarked on that bill. I think the Congress would characterize it less as a mandate and more as a change in regulatory environment. And there are very few things under Graham Leach Bliley that states have to do. It simply changes the regulatory climate, though, and causes the various stakeholders involved here to seek other changes at the state level. So there's nothing in the bill, for instance, that requires us to have a simpler and more coordinated rate and form review process, but the market dynamics in which banks and security firms have an easier route to form approval at the federal level puts pressure on state regulators to have a more coordinated system, too.
And then the second issue with regard to the 0103 anticipated results, you talked about working with the actuaries within the agency to make sure that the marketplace stays viable and healthy. How many actuaries do we have on staff in the insurance division?
Mr. Chairman, we have three. Well, we actually have two right now. We have three positions. There are two property and casualty positions and one life and health position, and we're in the process of filling that life and health position again.
And that's out of a total of just under 100 FTE, full-time employees.
That's right.
So, does the insurance division exercise any degree of oversight over the PERS?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we traditionally have not exercised any direct regulatory authority there. We have some communication, and lately there's been more of that communication to try to work more directly with them, with some of our knowledge of the insurance industry and that sort of thing. But it is not a regulatory responsibility of ours.
I realize the public employee retirement system has a major element of retirement resources, and that may not fall within the venue of the insurance division. I don't know. Lots of insurance companies provide those packages, retirement packages, but there's also a health insurance component within the PERS. Do they consult with you on a regular basis relative to the work that they do?
Mr. Chairman, the PEB side, I should say, there has been more of that consultation. On the PERS side, to my knowledge, not as much. But we do, to clarify my previous answer, we do regulate the health insurers and the other kinds of insurers who would be providing products to either PERS or PEB. So there is regulation of the private sector companies that are involved there. In my prior answer, I was saying there isn't any direct regulatory authority we have over either PERS or PEB. So to speak, and so that's more of a coordination and trying to share information. And I myself have been part of several meetings on the PEB side in the last year, but I don't believe we've had any real coordination on the PERS side.
And is it within the venue of the agency to oversee issues relative to retirement plans, where you are involved with insurance companies? I recognize that there's a federal law that talks directly to the Employment Retirement Income Security Act that addresses that. But does your agency through the insurance division, does it seek to control or advise or otherwise assist in retirement programs that are managed and monitored within the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, let me thank you for saying what the ERISA stands for, because I would have not been able to say that. So what you said there, that program does preempt our authority, basically, not only for retirement plans, but also for health plans for employers covered by that plan, which is most employers. So there, so we don't have authority because of that law, even on health plans. And in general, we don't have any regulatory responsibility for retirement planning per se. What we do have authority for is some of the insurance products that go into various retirement plans.
And that would be one of the reasons that you would have actuaries on staff, 2 to 3 actuary positions, in part.
Mr. Chairman, the actuaries are primarily focused on reviewing property. The two property and casualty actuaries review both commercial but even more personal lines filings to determine that the rates that are proposed are actuarially sound and comply with our statutes. And on the life and health side, they review primarily health rates. We do look at some actuarial information on life rates. We don't regulate life rates directly, though. So the focus there would be more on the actuarial basis for health rates.
Final question in that regard, Madam Chair, would be the PERS has a rather substantial staff, and I would think with the responsibilities that you have in the insurance division and having the responsibility to make sure that actuarially that the companies and the programs that you're dealing with are sound, would you, I'd just like your professional opinion, as long as we've got free counsel here, free advice, but I'd like your professional opinion out of the hundreds of employees that they have in PERS, how many actuaries do you think you'd find on their programs, in their system?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any idea, and I would really have a hard time even hazarding a guess. I could say this. One of the reasons why life rates are deregulated, we don't approve life rates, is because there's a competitive market out there. There are choices, and we basically rely on marketplace players to make informed decisions. So in that sense, there's a case to be made for PERS having their own professional talent to be able to sort out what are and what are not well-priced life products. We don't regulate that. We let the market take that, and that does presuppose that, particularly with larger players, that they have a sound number of, reasonable number of staff. Now, how many they ought to have in an organization like PERS, you'd have to give me a lot more facts and figures before I could give you a good assessment of that.
I'm sorry, it was kind of a trick question, but I just needed to know what your opinion. Out of 100 employees, you've got 3 positions that are actuaries, and I thought 3% would probably be a good figure to say where they've got a lot of products over there that are similar, and we need to ensure with the kerfuffle that we've got in the state that the program remains viable and constant, and that we have good actuarially sound work being done and a good product available, whether it's tier 1 or tier 2 or any other tier. And that's why I asked. These are I guess I shouldn't question the market driven forces, and I appreciate your comments earlier that basically the market is saying we've been successful in other states pricing products at this rate. Let us into your market and let us price the products within your market. And then if we're bad actors, bad characters, you can come and kick us around. And I think that's probably a good approach to take. As long as they've got some kind of a track record somewhere else, we don't need to be the guinea pig necessarily. But I appreciate that comment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I got to tell you one other thing here, which is my actuary always advises me, listen to your actuaries and tell your lawyers what to do. Don't listen to your lawyers. And this, I actually, over time, I think there's some merit to that. The actuaries do provide a very valuable source of information. And lawyers are always getting you in trouble.
Yeah. Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, if an acronym is 25 cents, how much is a word like guaffle?
That's got to be quite a bit.
that's a buck word easily. Those of us from Scappoose aren't familiar with that terminology, and I was searching for a definition.
That's something that's gloriously awful.
Thank you, sir.
Let's see, so we reinvent some words in the dictionary. That must be terrific fun. Anyway. Okay. If there's no more questions, thank you very much. Sorry I missed part of your testimony. I had to go give a speech, but I'm sure from what's going on here, I think everybody's well informed. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next we will have the overview for management. Staff ratio?
Yes. Deputy Director Lincoln will update the committee because of the questions that folks have had about the management staff ratio and whether or not positions are being cut.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the question is management staff versus line staff. And
one question as we get started. Is your definition, are your definitions of management and supervisor the same, or do you have management staff that are not supervisory?
Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, that's the main issue I want to cover. Yes, we do have management staff that are not supervisors,
okay.
And I would like to make that distinction in our...
Then we'll have numbers of ratio of supervisors to non-supervisors.
Yes, that's what this is,
yeah.
The handout that's in front of you is our count of positions, supervisory, non-supervisory, management, and line staff. We have a total of 1,154 positions across the bottom there, then 155 supervisory management positions. Jump a column to see the 999. Those are the rest of the positions, and they include that 50 non-supervisory management because our managers have to supervise our non-supervisory management as well. Let me just touch a minute on why I think that's an important distinction, and I understand that the people who testified earlier don't make that distinction, but I would like to raise that issue. These people are folks who have I think the term is community of interest with managers, but they are staff positions. They're not line positions. It includes all our personnel shop, which obviously must be in management service. It includes people like the actuaries that we just talked about. It includes our internal auditor, a couple of high-level policy advisors. Folks like that who provide staff services do have a community of interest with management, do have access to policymaking, personnel decisions, and those kinds of things, but don't directly supervise. So when we do our ratios, skip over to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th column, the ratio of staff to supervisors is the 6.45 ratio that the testimony last week said was their benchmark. When we make our cuts, the cuts that we are proposing to deal with the premium assessment operating account, we're proposing 23 cuts, position cuts. Three of those are managers, 20 are line staff, and it keeps our ratio flat. In the early 90s, as Senator Dukes pointed out, there was a mandate from the governor's office to broaden the span of control and to cut a certain number of managers, and it was kind of a one-size-fits-all mandate, which all agencies did. I was not with DCBS at the time, but all state agencies dealt with the same issue. It's very, very difficult, I think, to do that kind of a sweeping cut without looking at individual programs. What that did for DCBS is that one of our divisions, Building Codes, which wasn't part of DCBS at the time, took that very seriously. There was one manager that ended up with 60 direct reports who were spread all over the state. It's only recently that we were able to get him an assistant manager, and now they each have 30 direct reports, and that's still something that Building Codes is continuing to deal with, is that kind of span of control. There are places in DCBS that have a very small span of control. For example, the small business ombudsman is a three-person shop. The ombudsman himself is in management service. The other two positions are classified. But organizationally, it would be very difficult not to have a manager in that shop because what he is doing is managing the program, and he is out in the field all the time doing his small business ombudsman work. but he, those two positions, which work fairly independently, do report to him. So it's that kind of issue that we deal with when we look at managers versus staff. I would point out that under this calculation, Oregon OSHA has the highest ratio of staff to supervisors at 7.53 of any of our divisions. We are comfortable that the ratio is appropriate for the programs that we have. Our managers are all working managers, obviously. They not only manage the personnel, all the individual development, the performance reviews, the hiring, the firing, the grievance issues, the coaching, all those things that any manager does with personnel. They also deal with technical issues. They manage programs. They plan. They meet with stakeholders. So it's a very intense kind of situation that managers face. I guess I'll stop there and ask for questions.
Questions? Senator Dukes.
What was your ratio of staff to supervisors in 93?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I'd have to get that for you. Please remember that DCBS was very different. It was the Department of Insurance and Finance at that time. It did not include building codes, the appraisers board, the medical insurance pool, all those folks.
Lots of pieces that weren't there for both. I mean,
okay, when we'll make that comparison.
For them. I will claim, Madam Chair, that there isn't a whole lot of difference between the 91 session in terms of what we're looking forward to for the next 2 years and the 2001 session. The conservative numbers I look at, for those of you who are here in 2 years from now, is an $800 million shortfall coming in the door. And then, as we know, they never get better as we go through. So the notion that everybody had to lop off supervisors, and it was arbitrary. Yes, it was arbitrary, but it was arbitrary based on a huge budget shortfall. And so I'm really interested. And I'm not sure if your number's right or my number's right, and which of us have best memory, but it seems to me it was 12-1. And if that's the case, then you've doubled your rate in 10 years and of supervisors. And that actually concerns me, especially since I think we're going into bad times. And it's not that, I mean, you can justify every supervisory position we have in the state of Oregon. I don't think anybody's out there hiring supervisors just because they like to have supervisors hanging around. And so that's not the issue either. But it's just, I think it's something worth looking at. Those are more expensive positions. They are, generally speaking, not the ones who are out there on the front line delivering services. And we absolutely have to have supervisors, and I like supervisors, but we also have, they're more expensive positions, and we've got to watch them.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's a good thought to be cautious here. Further questions? Okay. Discussion of travel?
Yes, this is Madam Chair, members. This is also a presentation by Ms. Lincoln, and you have a handout in front of you that details in-state and out-of-state travel for all of the divisions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we've done is broken out in-state and out-of-state. We've also broken out regulatory versus professional travel. Regulatory travel is kind of DCBS's bread and butter. It's on-site inspections, particularly for OSHA and building codes. We have financial examiners that travel to banks and credit unions and other financial companies to do their inspections and their financial exams. Insurance auditors do the same thing, travel to insurance companies. So we've broken that out because we think it's important to show that we do have a very high travel budget. It is largely related to what we do as regulators. The professional budgets, both in-state and out-of-state, are attendance at conferences. There's an awful lot of national coordination, as Joel just talked about, in terms of regulation. Most of our regulatory programs have a national component. And it's important that we are able to keep up with that. We do as much as we can by video or by telephone or by web or by mail or on or whatever other ways. But in many cases, it's not possible to do the kinds of meetings face to face that we need to do. We are prepared to answer questions about individual budgets for you. Several of the administrators or the responsible folks are still here and can speak to their own budgets, and I'll just ask for questions at that point.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly the most dramatic is the Workers' Compensation Board. 808 to 6,000 for the out-of-state professional travel.
Am I reading this correctly?
Dramatic change, and why such a significant increase?
I see what you. Okay. Okay.
Or this column over. Let,
Maureen, do you want to come up and respond to that, please? Do we have a typo here, or what do we have?
It may be budget versus actually used.
That's what it is.
Okay. We do budget because we do have a number of professional meetings out there. As you see, we're very careful with our budget, and this biennium we only used $808 of that. But we do need to plan for some of those, and I'll let Maureen talk about the kinds of meetings that they do go to.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, members of the committee, in the past, board members frequently traveled out of state to attend International Association of Industrial Accident Boards and Commissions meetings as a group. When we restructured our agency,
as in, I didn't hear you, Peru?
As a group.
Oh,
not Peru.
No, they were always in this country.
Gotcha. I'm sorry.
Much as I'd love to see Lima, I don't think they'll send me there. And in response to our restructuring, we decided to conform our out-of-state travel more closely with the Department of Administrative Services guidelines, which say that only one person should attend an out-of-state meeting, absent some compelling reason. The times that we have spent or sent more than one person to an out-of-state meeting have been when there have been two meetings running simultaneously.
I'm very satisfied with that response, and you've explained why this huge discrepancy, actual used versus your projected budget for the next biennium. $800 is a very modest amount of travel. You can barely make it to a Seattle trip overnight for that. So I applaud you on your frugality, and I understand the presentation.
Are there any more questions pertaining to our
Senator Duke? Why is the reduction for the Building Codes Division in or OSHA in in-state regulatory travel?
Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, that relates to the cuts we're making in both those, all those budgets related to the lower premium assessment operating account and to the reductions in some of the revenues in the Building Codes Division, particularly manufactured housing. As we reduce positions, both management and staff positions, there's an automatic travel in the S&S formula that is reduced as well, and so we'll tighten that down in all those divisions.
Yeah. And I'm sure the rest of it works out, but I just, looking at the out-of-state travel professional and looking at the definition of that at the bottom of the page, I have to say, I don't know how many people are involved here that are doing the travel, but $360,000 just seems like a lot of money to me for out-of-state professional travel. I understand the value of being able to go and meet with other professionals in the same area from other states and perhaps even other countries to improve in your job, and I understand the value of many of the annual conferences and things. $360,000 is a lot of money. Oh, I'm sorry. I added it up. Now, I didn't ask to borrow Representative Butler's calculator, and I am not doing well this morning, so I will give you that. They may be off, but that's what I came up with, using all 10 fingers and toes. And if there's 20 of them in there, can I leave now?
You're fine. Representative Johnson.
A follow-up to that that I'd like to ask Ms. Lincoln is I was very pleased to hear the Workers' Comp Board indicate that they were subscribing to the DAS guidelines, one person at a conference unless there's a compelling reason. Can you assure me that you approach the out-of-state travel for the rest of the agency with those same DAS Department of Administrative Services guidelines?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, we do. Anytime more than one goes, I need a memo, a complete justification, and I have to sign off on it. Now, there are some associations where we kind of automatically send more than one person. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners meeting, and as Joel just testified, that's becoming almost a nationally regulated group, and it's imperative that we coordinate with the other 50 states. It's a very intense, very much a working meeting. Usually takes place over a weekend, but we usually send our administrator Joel, our actuary who works with other actuaries through those working periods, and perhaps one or two other folks who are necessary. If, for example, a national company is looking at insolvency and we need to be involved, so that meeting often requires more than one person. But we do justify those. We have those justifications, and we look very, very closely whenever we send. We need to send more than one person, and that is very rare.
The gentleman with the calculator tells me, Senator Dukes, you aren't too far off. $232,744.
Thank you. I had our folks working
then,
at it.
If you don't mind coming back up and talk to me about the out-of-state travel for the regulatory, I think probably Debbie touched on a bit. If you would expand on that a little bit, your 9901 budget, 100,000, 2001, 2003 budget, 115,000. Explain to me a little bit what's the importance of that travel.
Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, I thought we might get this question because I noticed that our number is a little higher than most of them, and it's really for the reason that Debbie said. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners is a group that meets quarterly, and at each of those meetings,
let me stop you. This is regulatory, which would be going out of state to look at insurance companies. Your professional
opinion. Oh, the 115,000. Yeah, that would be for examinations. The 100,000, though, I think for the 100 and the 115 for this biennium, we include in there the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. I'll get my quarter in a minute. Meetings, because they're primarily regulatory. Each of those quarterly meetings is really a series of 150 to 175 separate meetings. There are multiple tracks there. These days we typically send 5 or 6 people to those meetings because of all of the regulatory work that's going on to bring coordination to insurance regulation. Last week I sat down with several of our key stakeholders to talk about budget issues, where we were with the final budget and that sort of thing. And one of the comments that was made at that meeting, unsolicited, was if you want some of us to come in and testify as to the need for your travel, we'd be happy to do so. If anything, we think you ought to do more of it because it is helping bring a more efficient kind of perspective to regulation of insurance. And so I think we're in a period where we probably will have a higher than normal amount of travel. We will stand out if we're going to participate fully in these meetings. The last thing I'll say about it is that even in spite of those high numbers, relatively speaking, I probably say no to 2/3 of the requests. I could give you 4 meetings in the next couple weeks, each of which we're being told are absolutely critical for us to have 1, 2, or 3 people at, because they relate to some of these coordinated, say the rates and forms issue. Now there's a meeting in Kansas City next week to talk about how those 10 states can best accomplish their coordinated reviews. They want us to send 3 people. I'm sending 1. And so we make a lot. We don't say yes to all of this travel. We say no to most of it. But still, these days, it does amount to a fairly large number for us.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
And I do have some concern about that out-of-state regulatory travel because it is, in fact, an even 115% of the earlier number, and it's the only number that's increasing to that magnitude of the out-of-state travel across the board. Now, there are some, certainly, that are increasing travel, the Workers' Compensation Board, from, as we said earlier, from $800 to $6,800. But I guess I don't see the insurance industry as being quite so dynamic that we're increasing our travel by 15% straight across the board.
Madam Chair, can I clarify something? Is the number in the 1999-01 column the year-to-date or biennium-to-date actual, or is it the biennium-to-date projected? It is the projected. Okay.
Okay, do you want to go ahead, Joel, respond to Representative Butler's concern?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, again, I think it's that this is not, I think, going to likely be the situation for the indefinite future, but in this period where we are moving from each state doing its own form of regulation without a lot of coordination to a system where there's a lot of national coordination on a number of issues, agent licensing, rates and forms, the market conduct exams we do, what we hear. And we hear this more from the big national companies that hold a large market share in Oregon. You guys need to get your act together and coordinate state to state. Because, for instance, say take a state farm. With 50 states all doing their own approach to things, they might get examined by 30 different states in a given year because they're a large market player in almost every state in the country, and they are saying, I think with some justification, you folks need to get together and develop a more coordinated system so that instead of 30 different states coming in here for examinations, you work maybe on a zone basis and maybe coordinate and come in here for 4 examinations a year. It's those kinds of issues that are not real easy to work with. Sometimes they require changes in state law, like our agent licensing bill does this time, to accommodate a more coordinated system. Sometimes they're just a matter of administrative change, but all of those things are complicated to accomplish, and for us not to fully participate in the discussions means either we end up just accepting something that we really didn't have a say in for the state of Oregon, or maybe in the worst case, we don't accept it because we weren't a participant, and then we're seen as a state that's not trying to do its share to bring coordination. And
follow-up, and the concern I've got then, if we're going to become much more uniform and standard, and that many states are going together to do the regulatory process, then we should have a commensurate and rather sizable decrease in the overall regulatory cost. And that should be reflected in a diminishment or a reduction and the overall labor costs. If we're joining together 30 states to do state farm regulation, and we're going to expend 15% more to go and join together in that regulatory process, so that rather than each state come up with its own, and we're going to, and I fully concur that that would be a good thing to do, that we should join together in the regulatory rate setting process with 30 states, then rather than contributing 5 people for X amount of time, then we would contribute 1/30 of those 5 people for that X amount of time. And so I would say that if there is that kind of impetus to increase our regulatory travel to coordinate with other agencies, other states, and this kind of activity, then we need to show that, the benefit from it, rather than just travel, so that we're regulating and spending the same amount of time regulating. If this travel is in fact going to save us money, it should be reflected in our overall wage base at that point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I think you make an excellent point. Those are exactly the kind of questions I raise internally as we move forward, and I can't show you those results yet, but I can tell you already in the agent licensing area where we are moving towards an electronic system and a coordinated system, I would expect that we'll see some of those cost savings before too long. And some of these other areas, it may be 1, 2, 3 bienniums out before we actually get the full program put together. But I think your point's well taken, and if 6 years from now we're still saying we need to do all this travel to coordinate, but we haven't been able to reduce staff levels at all in some of these areas, I think the point, you know, it would be very strong.
It's interesting that he picked it. Joel, it's picked the 6 years. That's the maximum time they ever can have a surgery.
Be careful about that 6 years.
Okay, thank you very much. And anything else before we close the meeting? Robin?
Tomorrow, Madam Chair, we will do the fee bill. I believe that will be the first item on the agenda. And then we will do a work session on the budgets that we have heard today.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, committee, and we'll see you tomorrow.